right. We have three cases on our 9 o'clock docket. Before we begin, Justice McCoy and I would like to welcome our visiting justice with us today, former Justice Bill Brigham. He's sitting with our panel today. We'll begin with the Green versus Cook case. Ms. Bezak? Ms. Maher?
May it please the court. I'd like to preface this by reminding the court that this is under the new law as far as the Medical Malpractice Act and the Remedies Code. And the reason that's important is because this involves primarily non-economic damages. Annie Green and her husband are over retirement age, and so their economic damages would be limited to medical expenses. Of course, the primary cause of action pertains to the disfigurement of losing her eye and half her face due to non-diagnosed or misdiagnosed cancer. The deposition started in this case for the family members and the plaintiff herself. The plaintiff and four members of the family, four daughters, they call themselves, two of them are actual daughters and two are daughters-in-law, and they consider themselves all daughters of Annie Green. After the depositions were taken of the plaintiffs, obviously the defendant's deposition was to be taken. But at that time, there was requests for experts' depositions. This began in May. We were able to get the defendant's deposition, and letters had indicated that we needed the defendant's deposition before our experts' depositions, obviously, so they could review those depositions and before they gave their opinions and conclusions. The defendant's deposition was taken at the very end of May. After the deposition, Mr. Lunningham asked for deposition dates again of experts, and until the transcript of the deposition was completed and until the experts could review it, we could not provide him with dates. But anyway, when we did get the transcript, we were fine with as far as getting dates together for the experts' deposition. The problem began when there was a request for a discovery deposition prior to a trial deposition. Now, in the time that I've been practicing law, I've never heard of two depositions being taken of each expert. It should be remembered that these experts, and the reason I preface this about the new law cases is because regardless of how much a jury would award in this case, if any, regardless of how much negligence they would apportion to Dr. Cook, she's limited to $250,000, and that's with attorney's fees and also with case costs. Two of the experts, one is in Houston and one is in Evanston, Illinois. The other one is in Dallas, so there's three experts. So that would mean six experts' depositions if we were to take two expert depositions of each expert. Based on that, there was a motion from the defense a motion to compel depositions. Even though we had no problem providing dates, and we had no problem with the defendant starting the deposition. This was before Judge Cressman, who was at the 46th District Court, who was located in Parker County also. We went before Judge Cressman, and he ruled that if the defendant wanted to take a second deposition or a deposition of the expert separate and apart as a discovery deposition, he could do so, but he would have to pay for the expert's deposition. And even though I would have to fly twice to Evanston, Illinois, and go to Houston twice, I had no problem with that. But evidently Mr. Lunningham did. So he did a motion for rehearing. The motion for rehearing was before Judge Quisenberry, who is the judge that's before this case. And this was the first hearing we had before Judge Quisenberry. Although I assumed that it was being transcribed because the court reporter was at the hearing and she was at the table, and it's blocked as far as what you could see as far as typing. She was there, and then when I asked for a transcript of the hearing, I was told that it wasn't transcribed. I believe that and the motion for continuance were the only two hearings that weren't transcribed. But anyway, at that hearing, Judge Quisenberry stated that we'd have approximately 10 days to get the deposition dates, three deposition dates of every of each expert. And so we attempted to do that, which is very difficult when you have expert schedules that also are our professors, you know, teaching. So we provided dates to him, and the dates that we provided, I did get three dates for everyone except for Dr. Mary Crow. Dr. Mary Crow is in Houston, and she was out of town at the time, and we left messages, but we weren't able to get them before the deadline date. We went ahead and faxed over on Friday, Friday evening. It was after 5 o'clock, but we faxed over the deposition dates, and the order specifically said by that Friday. It doesn't say anything about the time of it. And on the weekend, I don't think anyone would be able to schedule depositions anyway. But anyway, we faxed those over to defense counsel, and defense counsel immediately complained that, number one, we didn't have Mary Crow's deposition dates, even though we explained that she was out of town and we weren't able to get the dates from her. But the other thing was that on Monday, that Monday at 4:47 p.m., he noticed the deposition of the Evanston doctor in Evanston, Illinois, for the following Wednesday. So there was actually 24 hours in between time before the deposition dates. Based on that,
was that one of the dates that you had agreed to, the two dates that you weren't on vacation or out of town?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. That was a date that Dr. Wenick had given us previously. In fact, actually before the court order. So we had provided him with the dates that we'd gotten from Dr. Wenick. If you look at the deposition notices of the defense throughout prior to this time, all the deposition notices are for Dr. Irwin, the liability expert, the only liability expert, and the liability expert is in Dallas, Texas. If you look at also the chart that I provided showing the dates that the experts were available, it had Dr. Irwin was available on the date that he wanted to take Dr. Wenig's deposition, which was before, I believe it was, well, it was before the deposition of Dr.
We got Crow, Wenig, and Irwin.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I didn't have the. There's an exhibit in there. It's called, I think it's under the reporter's record 3, and it's 1A, I believe it is, and has it has the calendar indicating when the depositions of the doctors could be taken. The only thing that Mr. Lunningham had to do would be to have the deposition of Dr. Irwin first, which he had asked for and noticed for deposition, the other notices that he had, and then take Dr. Wenig on the date that he was taking Dr. Irwin's. It was just a matter of changing those two dates. Mr. Lunningham refused to do that, and then there was a motion to compel. In fact, actually, the motion to compel the deposition dates, which the order was from Judge Quisenberry, was based upon really a motion for reconsideration of Dr. Cressman's ruling. So anyway, because of that, the judge, we had another one on a motion for sanctions, another hearing. On the motion for sanctions, Judge Quisenberry indicated that it didn't matter which one he wanted to take first, and even though that there was less than 24 hours in between times from the notice of the deposition until the time that we would be in Evanston, Illinois, there was apparently 18 hours of work devoted to preparing for this deposition. There was no plane ticket produced. There was an affidavit, which I never saw. In fact, actually, when the judge, when he admits the affidavit of the defense counsel, as far as the time that he devoted on that, I said, well, I haven't seen that. And the judge says admitted. So there was no cross-examination of Mr. Carraway because Mr. Carraway wasn't present, and he was the one who was supposedly going to take the deposition. Mr. Lunningham couldn't do it on that date either.
Let me ask a question on the motion for sanctions hearing. Was that properly recorded so that you do have a transcript of that?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I do have a transcript of the hearing on the motion for sanctions.
But the motion to compel, there's no transcription of that hearing.
The motion to compel with Judge Cressman, there is.
Okay.
The motion to compel in front of Judge Quisenberry, the first one, there was no recording on it. And, in fact, in the second hearing that we had before Judge Quisenberry, and I pointed out to the court in my brief, I had to ask, is this being recorded? Because the court reporter was in the same position, doing the same thing, and she said, she nodded, and we went on. So there wasn't a recording there. You'll also notice in the motion for continuance, it goes into as far as motion for continuance of the summary judgment hearing, and then the summary judgment hearing itself is not on the record, even though there is no indication that that portion of it wouldn't be recorded.
So let's move towards your main complaints, and that is that your continuance wasn't granted and
yes, Your
Honor. That the sanctions were imposed against you.
I don't think, even though the defense has not even even commented on the motion for sanctions, when you have experts that are in a medical malpractice case, you can't even start the case without experts. And because of this, and because of the expense of experts, what we wanted to do was trying to conserve the cost as much as we could for the plaintiff, not have six depositions of three experts. That was the only thing we were attempting to do. In the period of time that we were on the experts' depositions, actually, there's only a couple of months that we had before the trial date. If you look at the December dates as far as where we were going to have depositions, it was February that we're having. February 7th, I believe, was the trial date. So we're talking about only a couple of months. In that period of time, before I had to, the sanctions were imposed, and if you look at the two orders, first of all, the judge imposed monetary sanctions, and he also struck Dr. Crow, I believe, in the first, even though that wasn't at the hearing. He decided to do this, after the hearing. He had an order from defense counsel, and he struck Dr. Crow, who was in Houston. And then the second order, which was amended, and I guess was amended primarily because he had 2007 dates down rather than 2008, but he amended it, and he struck instead Dr. Wenig and imposed additional sanctions. So because of the striking of experts, Your Honor, as far as going through with, we had the liability expert deposed, but we needed the damage experts, and this is one of the things as far as even the beginning of the case, we had two experts' reports, one for liability and one for damages, before we began the lawsuit. We couldn't prove our case without having a damage expert. It's one thing to say a person's liable, but it's another thing to say, well, what are the damages resulting from that liability? And so that was the dilemma we were in. We had two experts that were struck. Mary Crow was then asked to the judge asked me, well, do you understand only one expert has been struck? Because I guess he changed his mind from Dr. Crow to Dr. Wenig. But then Dr. Crow gave me dates when she returned to town for any Tuesday and Thursday. She tried to be as open as possible. She said in Houston in the afternoon. And sure enough, the defense deposed, noticed the deposition to depose her on a Monday morning in their office. That was an impossibility. And I don't even know how much time that they gave, for her, but that was basically it. So because of that, Your Honors, I believe that the sanctions and as far as the motion for continuance based on lack of evidence, my father had passed away. I was gone for the week we had depositions noticed, and those depositions, once they were noticed, had to be rescheduled. We didn't have time to do that when I returned.
Why didn't you just get affidavits?
Well, Your Honor, as
far as... off the summary judgment.
Well, Your Honor, I didn't even have time to respond to the motion for summary judgment. If you look at what the time element was, when I returned to town, there wasn't 7 days to respond to this motion for summary judgment. I think it was darned if you do or darned if you don't. I don't think there's any way that this judge would have accepted an affidavit. It would have been untimely. That's basically what he said as far as the motion for continuance. And I think my time for this session is about up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Maher. Mr. Lanningham.
May it please the court, counsel. I represent Dr. Ronald Cook, a general dentist who was sued for malpractice. The thrust of the case was that Dr. Cook did not diagnose a squamous cell carcinoma earlier than the diagnosis was made by Ms. Green, one of the appellant's physicians. The case is governed by Chapter 74 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. There are two primary points in this appeal. One is that the court abused its discretion by entering a death penalty sanction against the appellant, and second, that the court abused its discretion in denying a continuance of a no-evidence summary judgment hearing, which was scheduled for the Friday before the trial was to begin the following Monday. The briefing by the appellant and some of the argument today is far outside of the record, and I've addressed that in our reply brief. I would further point out that the summary judgment motion, there is an implication that there was an attempt to somehow take advantage, but that motion was filed at the last possible day so that it could be heard before the trial setting, as no evidence had ever materialized in this case to support the plaintiff's or the appellant's contentions.
Well, did you have experts' reports that are required on the outset of the suit?
Yes, the okay. Appellant had expert reports.
So obviously you had some idea where she was coming from.
Theories had changed in the case, and so there were those reports. Those reports were not challenged at the time that they were issued, but I would say that the theories as in the two-year track of the case had changed over time. There was a rather storied history and procedural history to the case. It is true that the trial court had entered an order of sanctions against counsel for the appellants, not against the appellants, after hearing all of the arguments in more than one hearing and at more than one time. However, I think it is important to point out to this court that at no time did the trial court ever enter any death penalty sanction or enter any sanction at all that would have impeded the appellant's ability to respond to the summary judgment motion. In fact, in the December 3rd hearing and in the order that followed that hearing, which there was an initial order and it was corrected within a day by the court to his original intent, and this all happened in December. In that order, the trial court, Judge Quisenberry, had denied specifically the relief of striking the experts, Dr. Crow, and striking Dr. Irwin, so that the plaintiff or the appellant was left with an intact set of experts at all times. The court...
Is Irwin the damage expert?
Irwin was a dentist whose it appeared his purported testimony was going to be on standard of care.
Okay. Who's the damage expert? Because Crow has an oncology practice, so that doesn't sound like a damage expert. So if the
causation expert, it would be the better term.
All right. Who's the damage expert?
I don't think there were no other experts.
All right. What is Winnig?
Dr. Winnig was also an oncologist. And so Dr. Winnig and Dr. Crow were the same of the same specialty.
Okay.
Which played into the court's reasoning, and you can see that in the record from the hearing as to how he approached this in the December 3rd hearing. But the denying of a continuance is not a sanction. It was never a sanction, and so the analysis for this court is not an analysis under Rule 215. The In fact, at the time that the summary judgment hearing took place, Dr. Irwin had already been deposed, yet no attempt was made to present any of Dr. Irwin's testimony to the trial court in response. The affidavit of Ms. Maher, which was attached to the motion for continuance, stated that Dr. Irwin's videotaped deposition had not been taken. But the fact is, and the record reflects, that Dr. Irwin's deposition had been taken and could have been submitted to the court had it supported the appellant's case, and had it provided, had they chosen to provide that deposition.
But you agree with her affidavit where she says it was not videotaped, but it was properly transcribed and all of that. Is that the distinction?
It was not videotaped.
Okay.
But there was a deposition.
Right, okay.
That is correct. And, in fact, at that deposition, Ms. Maher had questioned her. This is, again, her own retained expert, and she had examined her own retained expert in that deposition.
So are you suggesting that Irwin standing alone would establish standard of care, breach, and causation?
No.
Okay.
I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is that in the analysis of the granting of a continuance, there are certain things that must be shown under Rule 166A-G and under Rule 252 when a party moves for continuance and there is absent testimony. Part of what you show the court is what is absent, what diligence you've used, and then what you expect to show in the testimony. So Dr. Irwin's deposition would have purportedly been able to provide the appellants with at least part of their case. And I say it that way because, Your Honor, all along in this case, this being a case in which the issue was timeliness of diagnosis, there was never it was our contention that the evidence did not exist. This is not a gotcha situation. The evidence simply did not exist to say that there was going to be a diagnosis or a breach of the standard of care that would have changed the outcome. And our motion for summary judgment was specifically addressed that point.
Well, did you have a report from these experts? Not the initial report, subsequent report?
Yes.
Well, and did they address that in their report?
They attempted to address it, but there was a disconnect between the opinions of Dr. Irwin, which changed from his report to his deposition, and the oncology experts and the timing of when they say the die was cast in terms of the outcome of the cancer. So it is my belief that had we followed through and had the depositions been taken as the court had ordered, that we would have been in the same position. That is, there would have still have been no evidence that would have supported the case. But importantly is the motion for continuance that was filed and heard by Judge Quisenberry. As I've stated, the Rules 166A, G, and Rule 252 are very important in this matter. Rule 166AG states that should it appear from the affidavit of a party opposing the motion that he cannot, for reasons stated, present by affidavit facts essential to justify his opposition to the court may refuse the application for judgment or may order a continuance to permit affidavits to be obtained. Further, Rule 252, which governs continuances generally, says that if the ground for such application be the want of testimony, the party applying, therefore, shall make affidavit that such testimony is material, showing the materiality thereof, and that he has used due diligence to procure the testimony stating such diligence. The rule goes on to require that you show what is expected to be proven by the absent witness. In this case, the materiality is not addressed in the single affidavit, the two-paragraph affidavit of Ms. Maher, which is all that was presented to Judge Quisenberry at the time of the continuance. There is no showing as to what would have been the expected testimony from either of these witnesses, and therefore the materiality element was not met. But I think it's also important to understand that there was also no showing in that affidavit of the due diligence to try and acquire the evidence. If you go back and look at Rule 166AG, it talks specifically about affidavits. And the nothing presented to Judge Quisenberry ever stated why affidavits were not obtained to respond to the summary judgment, either timely or late.
What do we do about the fact, though, that 166AG doesn't require necessarily materiality and due diligence as opposed to maybe 252?
I don't think that, well, I believe that a summary judgment proceeding is a proceeding, and I believe there's case law that supports that it is considered the same as a trial proceeding. I don't think that Rule 166AG is saying you don't have to meet these other requirements. What it's saying is that given the fact that we have more lenient standards with summary judgment, you need to explain why you couldn't obtain the affidavits. To me, that is very much like the due diligence requirement of Rule 252, because it says cannot, for reasons stated, present the affidavit of the absent witness. So to me, that's the interplay of those two rules, is that one is just more specific in the context of summary judgment than the other one. But the affidavit of Ms. Maher also never says, and nowhere in this record is it ever stated, that the appellant could not have obtained the affidavit from Dr. Crow and an affidavit from Dr. Irwin, or just submit the deposition of Dr. Irwin that had already been taken if the appellant felt that was going to fend off the summary judgment. It is still my contention that it would not have fended off the summary judgment, and that is the better reason or a better explanation for why the material was not presented. But it presents another problem for this court, and that is the harmful error issue. Because there was no showing as to what the expected testimony would be from Dr. Irwin or Dr. Crow, there is no record that indicates that even if this court found there was an abuse of discretion by Judge Quisenberry, that it amounted to harmful error, because there is no showing that, in fact, the testimony of Irwin or the testimony of Crow would have been material, would have overcome the no evidence points in the summary judgment. I'd also point out that there has been no challenge to the sufficiency of the motion for summary judgment, and it was very specific. And for the reasons that I've stated here, we would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the trial court below.
Thank you, Mr. Lenningham. Ms. Maher?
Thank you, Your Honor. As far as the timing, I think it's very important to understand that as the motion for summary judgment was filed after the defense counsel received a call from or a letter, a facsimile from my office, that my father had been hospitalized and was called away. That was right after the hearing on the 14th of January. On the 15th, I left at 4:30 in the morning. On the 16th, the motion for summary judgment was filed. It was not served on us. It was hand-delivered on the 17th. Therefore, by the time that my father passed away on the 20th, There was a letter from my office to defense counsel's office. There was something like five depositions scheduled for that week or the following week, and that they would have to be rescheduled because of the funeral and burial. When I returned on Saturday evening, at the time that I have this in, and I think this is what he was referring to, on Monday I had a mediation, a burden mediations. And so on Tuesday when I came into the office, even if I'd come into the office, actually, unless I was there by Friday and had it written, and that was the, like I said, we were having the funeral and the wake, even if I was there back here on Friday, which I was not, we had the funeral, as I said, I wouldn't have been able to timely file a motion for summary judgment with affidavits. The defense realized, like I said, that I was gone. They realized the circumstances, and yet this is how it transpired. As far as the oncologist speaking of, as far as the damages, and I think one of the justices had asked the question as far as which one was the damage expert, Dr. Irwin had said in his report, had the Dr. Cook diagnosed the cancer back in, when he first started seeing her back in March or any time earlier, up to a six-month period. I think it was 9 months before the cancer was detected, even though she had many, many complaints that would indicate that there was something wrong and that he should have referred. In fact, that's what Dr. Irwin said, should have referred him to another doctor, that she would not have lost her eye and she would not have had the disfiguring loss of half her face had this been done. Dr. Irwin could not testify as to that. That's why we had two reports in the very beginning of the case before when we filed suit as far as both damages and also on liability. The other thing as far as on Dr. Irwin, and this is in the record, as far as when he was able to get his deposition, he noticed it and said it would be videotaped. We went there with a videographer and that. The videographer came there early. He was sent away. Dr. Irwin was there early. And I came in 5 minutes after him, and he was sitting in the conference room. Dr. Irwin said that he had dismissed the court reporter, and then I had to call the judge to try and get the defense counsel to take the deposition of Dr. Irwin. I knew that I was going to have to take his deposition again because I wasn't able to get it videotaped, and because of that, the questions weren't asked by me during that deposition. I was supposed to have another time to take the deposition that was going to be videotaped and supposedly a trial deposition. So those are the, like I said, six depositions for three experts, and I've never heard of anything before like that, but we were going along with what the judge had ruled. The only thing is he did strike first Dr. Crow, and then he decided to strike Dr. Wenig instead, and then when Dr. Crow was noticed for a deposition she couldn't possibly attend, which the defense knew, any Tuesday or Thursday afternoon in Houston was available, and yet he deposed her or noticed her deposition for his office on Monday morning, and it was an impossibility. So in essence, and then he had a motion to strike Dr. Irwin for other reasons, which I have no doubt that Dr. Irwin would have been struck, and even if he hadn't, we wouldn't have a damage expert with the oncologist, both of them struck. So basically, it was death penalty sanctions, and as far as being able to respond to the motion for summary judgment, I wasn't back in town because of the circumstances within the time period that we could respond, and I'm sure that based on previous hearings, as the court can read from the transcript, Judge Quisenberry would not have ruled any other way than he did in this case. So because of that, I believe the abuse of discretion from the very beginning of the case until the denial of the motion for continuance of the summary judgment and sanctions against the plaintiff in striking their experts, that is sanctions against the plaintiff. It's not sanctions against plaintiff's counsel. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Maher. Mr. Lanningham, your case is submitted and you are excused.